Succession number 5202, reel number 2.
Mr. Salmon, reel 2.
Identification of aircraft was something I was been interested in for years, and in 1938 I was posted to a place called Signal Hill, or Blackhead Fort as it's also known, which is a lighthouse-like structure on the end of the Kowloon Peninsula. And my job in those days was to observe and record all aircraft landing or taking off from the aerodrome. There was also four other people in the same place that used to record all shipping coming in. And of course in those days there wasn't a great deal of aerial activity, but occasionally we used to get the Japanese aircraft flying high overhead. And
military aircraft was this?
Military aircraft, mainly Japanese aircraft from their cruisers. But they just used to overfly Hong Kong territory and then straight out to sea again. There was nothing we could do about it because all we had in those days was a few wildebeest torpedo bombers and some walrus amphibian aircraft. They had nothing in the way of fighters or that, so the Japanese could more or less do what they liked. It's quite interesting. We used to have a number of airlines using Hong Kong. Imperial Airways was the British airline. They used to fly de Havilland 86As out from England. Used to take in those days 8 days to come from England by air to Hong Kong. We used to have the Eurasian Airways, which was a Sino-German company that used to fly JU-52s down from China down to Hong Kong and back again. We used to have Air France. They used to come in once a week. We used to have the Pan American Clippers. They used to come in twice a week from the States. And then our local aircraft in those days, apart from the Royal Air Force, which I've mentioned previously, was wildebeest bombers and walrus. We had a private flying school out there. I used to have a couple of de Havilland Hornet moths and tiger moths. This was about the limit of the aircraft out there.
Did you ever take part before the war started in any exercises for the defence of Hong Kong?
Oh yes, once a year we used to have, or once or twice a year, we used to have an exercise, and we used to be dispersed from Lai Moon out to our war posts. These were scattered all the way around Hong Kong, and in one exercise I remember we had to manhandle two 3-inch 20 underweight guns to the top of a very steep, not very high, but a very steep hill called Houston Hill. And that was quite a job to lift 20 underweight guns up purely by manual labour. Then when we got the guns to the top, we dug slit trenches and then waited for attack by the enemy, which was another infantry regiment that pretended to be the enemy, and attacked us up there. We used to be issued with 5 rounds of blank 303 ammunition each, and that was about the limit. another exercise I can remember was we were dug in at Deepwater Bay, which was on the south side of the island. Again, five rounds of blank, and we waited for one of the infantry regiments to come ashore by boat. Cutters, actually. Yeah. And it was all very, how shall I say, laughable when we look back on it afterwards, to see how static was our deployment compared to what was going to happen a couple of years ahead when the Japanese attacked.
In what way? Can you expand on that?
Well, in those days, we used to just lie on the beach with our rifles pointed out to see, and that was beach defence. And of course, if we had done that when the Japanese come, we would have been just slaughtered. In fact, we were to some extent on some of the places. But everything was static. There was no mobile deployment of anywhere. Although our guns were to some extent mobile, we just had them in cement pits in static locations, so it's impossible to shift them from one place to another. And this went not only for the artillery, but also for other regiments. Everything was static. Pill boxes, and this is why the Japanese were able to do so well when they did land, in the fact they were completely mobile and was able to bypass all our fixed points.
So the guns were concreted down?
I'm not going to say the guns themselves were concreted down, but they were in concrete pits and bolted down. They could be shifted. In fact, they were shifted from time to time, but invariably only for servicing. Or
you said that, looking back on it, it was laughable, but did you take these exercises seriously at the time?
Not really. I think we took them as being a diversion from the normal run of events, and something to look forward to. To go to a strange or different place, and instead of training on a dummy load all the time, you trained on real guns, and it was something new, something adventurous to some extent.
How did the defence of Hong Kong appear to you and your comrades? Did it seem before the war that it was an invulnerable fortress, or did you feel that it was very exposed?
I don't think we paid a lot of attention to that side of it, for a simple reason. We had a very poor opinion of the Japanese, and I think this was pretty general throughout services in the Far East, in our own services. We had a very poor opinion, and all this business of saying that they can't fly at night time and everything like that, we really believe those things.
Why should they not be able to fly at night?
Well, they said the Japanese, by their diet, a rice diet and that, their eyesight was bad and this. I think it was a certain amount of propaganda put about it. I mean, even back here, I think you had a pretty poor opinion of the Japanese until they actually started. Nobody really thought of them much as a fighting army.
Had not the Japanese performance in China affected army opinions?
It may have done in the upper echelons, but certainly not down the bottom. We derided to some extent the Japanese. We didn't think that they would never think of attacking Hong Kong. you know, we were part of the British Empire, and they would never attack us. We knew that they had a good navy. But as regards because their navy was trained by the British Navy, I mean, perhaps we were mean, they, everybody used to think Japanese had buck teeth and wore glasses, and they were little short, squat people. And I don't think that we really took them seriously.
So the British soldier hadn't gained any impression of a good Japanese performance in China?
Not really, but we didn't know a great deal about it. You must remember, in those days we never had television, or we never had the constant radio bulletins or news broadcasts that you have nowadays, and we knew very little that was going on. There was little items in the paper, newspaper, whereas the Chinese had advanced, or the Japanese had taken this city, but it just went in one ear and out the other.
To what extent do you think that the life and training for the British Army units in Hong Kong before the war prepared them adequately for what was about to happen in 1941?
I don't think it did. I don't think it did, to be honest. All our training was based upon the 1418 war. Static defences, our equipment was all 1914-18. We never saw any new equipment. We used to be more interested in the pre-war army of blankering your equipment and polishing your brasses than you ever did about learning to be able to fire off accurately a number of rounds. We used to go to the rifle ranges, which was behind Kai Tak or on Stonecutters Island, once a year, in which we had to fire off, I think it was 20 rounds or 25 rounds, I'm not quite certain. We used to fire off at 200 yards, 400, 600 and 800, and this was considered all the training that we needed.
So what standard of proficiency was achieved with marksmanship?
Well, with such a small amount of ammunition available, who could say? You may have been lucky and got one or two balls, but you certainly did a lot of training without live ammunition. Everything was on dummy loaders, even the rifles. You used to have it with the mirroring, in which you used to have to line it up, and then they come around and check your sights. We did everything but use ammunition. This was the same with the firing the anti-aircraft guns. We used to go to a camp once a year, usually at on the Stanley Peninsula. I'm talking about before Stanley Barracks was built. It was we used to live under canvas up there, and the guns used to go up, and we used to go up there for about a week, and the guns used to fire, I think, 10 rounds per gun in a whole week. Well, this was all the training that the guns got, and they were the aircraft target was a Wildebeest bomber, which had a top speed, I think, cruising speed of 80 knots, 84 knots or something like that. And they used to have 1,000 feet of line out with a drogue on the end of it, so you can imagine what the speed was then. And this is what we used to fire at a steady height of, I think, 8 to 10,000. No, very slow, I mean. So when we had to fire at Japanese aircraft down 200 or 300 miles an hour, we were completely hopeless. We had no training at all on that. Our predictors and height finders just couldn't keep up with the. Everything used to be at as it was in the 1914-18 war.
Did you have any special training for dealing with possible civil disturbances or riots in Hong Kong?
No, not to my knowledge. No, we never did any practice for that. Maybe the infantry regiments had a certain amount for internal security, but certainly not amongst the Royal Artillery. Although we used to, of course, do our own security of our own particular areas.
What did that involve?
Apart from the normal guard duties, we had pickets in different places and roving patrols around the perimeter of the different camps.
Did any civil disturbances occur, in fact, whilst you were in Hong Kong?
No. No, we had no civil disturbances. We had a number of things like the typhoons and that, which affected the whole community, in which army troops to some extent was used to help the civilian aid services. But as regards internal security, no. If there was, I know nothing about it.
Did you and your comrades in Hong Kong at this time, before the war, pay any attention to the political situation in China at the time?
No. No, not. Only from the point of view of, we knew that the nationalist government was completely corrupt. And in those days, China was a very vast, well, same as it is now, a very vast country, but it was completely broken up in segments. You never had the communications that you have nowadays. You used to get a village in which nobody that village had ever gone 50 miles from outside that village. So you had these isolated communities which used to be under the control of a local, you can call him a warlord, I think most people call them warlords, and he was the, he had power of life and death. This was very similar to the old serfdom days in England, in which you had the lord of the manor, which had the power of life and death, more or less, over the people that used to live in his vicinity. And this was how it was in China, right up until about 1939, 38, 39, so that you couldn't think of China as being a unified structure. You had your government of Chiang Kai-shek in Chongqing, but he only controlled a certain amount of the big cities. Outside of that, of course, it was under the local warlords.
How did you know that the nationalist government was corrupt?
It's very hard to say. It was just one of those things that everybody used to talk about. And no, I mean, when the Japanese went in to, say, Canton, of course, all the government, the mayor and all the high government officials all come down to Hong Kong, flew down, some of them chartered their own planes and brought all the wealth of the country down there, and they opened up their mansions and they brought all their servants down to this. There was a lot of aid to China money that America used to give to China, but this used to find its way into just the corrupt government officials. This was a widely held belief, and I think it's perfectly true, as after events have proved.
Did you actually go across the border into China proper?
Yes. In those days, there wasn't, the border was just on paper. There was no patrolling of the border. There was, when the Japanese come down on the border, it was a different thing altogether. But before that, there was free movement. You could, provided you had the money, you could go up by train up to Canton, and you could come down by riverboat. There was a lot of free movement. Or go up to Shamchan. They used to have a casino up there, the other side of the border. Oh yes, I went up to Canton for a trip. As I say, there was no formalities as regards passports or anything like that.
So you didn't even need a passport to cross over? So what were your impressions of Canton when you visited it?
or be in a completely well, it's just what we anticipated a Chinese city will be, a vast multitude of poor people, and you had a few rich ones. In fact, many people used to go up there to watch executions. They used to have public executions up there in those days. They used to behead them. In fact, Hong Kong, the pre-war, they used to sell a series of photographs there. They used to go up and take photographs of the different executions, rather a gruesome thing. But in those days, life was so cheap up there. I mean, coming on to about 1938-39, when the Japanese landed at a place called Bias Bay, which is a few miles north of Hong Kong, and went into Canton, they drove a lot of refugees down into Hong Kong and started to flood the place with refugees. And these mainly sleeping on the streets, and there used to be a number of them that used to die in the cold weather, especially. Found starving. In fact, if one walked around the more suburb part of Hong Kong, if you can really put it that way, anywhere else other than the main central district, you used to have to step over these people. So the whole streets were covered in these street sleepers.
Were there families?
Oh yes, individuals and families. There was a lot of poverty, and life was very cheap.
When you went to Canton, did it just seem a big city like Hong Kong, or were there differences?
Oh no, differences. The main thing was it was very flat. You just had the normal Chinese type of buildings. You never had any large buildings. Mostly it was built around the waterfront. You didn't verbally go much beyond the waterfront. If you're up there for a few hours, you stayed in the more western parts of Canton. One of the things you didn't do in those days was go hunting by yourself in the purely Chinese section.
Would that have been dangerous?
Well, it's not that, but you, unless you spoke the language, you could very easily get lost. Whether you would have been dangerous or not, I don't think people wanted to take a chance on it. Another thing pre-war is that the Navy, which had two or three old destroyers and that, they used to take a number of service people from time to time up for 3 or 4 days. They used to do what they used to call anti-piracy patrols. There was a lot of piracy pre-war in those days between Hong Kong and Shanghai, and especially around all the bays, Bias Bay up to Amoy Swatow. And I went out on one of the destroyers, the Thanet, and for 3 days we went up and visited all these little bays, and we did plenty of swimming, and we took the cutters ashore. And but whenever we used to go ashore in the purely Chinese sections, everybody used to disappear. You'd find a whole village with nothing in it. They used to disappear.
You were looking for contraband, were you?
I think the Navy were. It was just to show the flag and see any pirates there. But of course most of the coastal villages around there were haunts of pirates. Even Hong Kong, some of the fishing villages were haunts of pirates. But it was just a case of showing the flag every so often you went up there.
Did you see any contraband discovered?
Oh no, no. We went up there, we went in some of the temples, and they were very poor. But there was never anybody to be seen. They used to go up into the hills as soon as they saw a Navy boat pull into the bay.
Did they seem to be frightened of the Navy?
Probably with good cause, yes, they seemed to be. They preferred to disappear until it went.
How long did this anti-piracy patrol take?
Well, we used to. I went out for 3 days. I think this was the general trend. It was, I mean, it only took about 4 or 5 hours steaming to get up to the area that I'm talking about.
So how did you manage to be taken on this?
Oh, I think that you could put your name down in your regiment. They used to say that there's what they used to call fresh air cruises with the Navy, and you used to put your name down. How they used to pick you out, I don't know, but you used to go in parties of about 10 or 15 at a time. We had on an island to the south of Hong Kong, Chung Chau, we used to have one or two fresh air homes in which troops could put their name down, and if they were lucky they could go over there for a week. It was a sort of leave camp to get you away from the normal routine, and especially if you were out there for 3-4 years without any chance of any home leave, they had to have something like this.
Did you go yourself?
Oh yes, I went on one of the Navy trips, and I went to one of the week home leave or holiday leave places on Chung Chau Island.
What was it like?
By missionaries, very good, nothing to do, good food, and just do nothing but swimming and hiking and that all the time.
Was it not organised by the army though?
Oh yes, it was organised by the army, although the camp itself was run by, I think, missionaries, or something like the WVS. But it was certainly run by, or controlled by the services.
You mentioned the refugees fleeing from the Japanese. Mm. But apart from that, was there a constant stream of refugees, of immigrants coming into Hong Kong all the time?
No, I wouldn't say that. You could say that, not as there is nowadays, immigrants coming into the city. I would say these were more displaced people that come in. You got the Japanese going through a village and destroying the village and the crops, and that, and the people just were uprooted and they used to come into Hong Kong. In fact, the Hong Kong government set up one or two refugee camps. When they got full, they used one of the ferry boats that used to go between Hong Kong and Canton. They were using this anchored in the harbour as a boat for putting these displaced people on. We used to get a lot of the Chinese soldiers as well come down. You see, that when they were cut off by the Japanese, they used to throw away their uniforms and then come into Hong Kong. In fact, on the border there was always uniforms and arms being found.
Were you and your comrades before the war in Hong Kong aware of the communist presence in mainland China?
No, I don't think there was in those days a very strong communist presence, at least not in South China. In North China, I mean, this is where they developed up in North China. In fact, South China was the last province to be taken over by the communist. No, I think North China, and we were completely out of touch with that.
Had you ever heard of Mao Zedong and the other communist leaders?
Not until after the war.
When the European war broke out, did that affect your life as soldiers in Hong Kong in any way?
Well, yes, I would say mainly in the fact that we were completely concerned about our sort of loved ones and relatives back here in UK. There was no way in which we could contact them. We couldn't phone them up or that, and letters were few and far between. You didn't know how long it was going to be before mail could get out there and back again. So we were more or less cut off from them, never knowing what was happening. And